the Our Lady of Consolation Choir, and we'll have a quick listen to this. Okay, let's see.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was Our Lady of Consolation Church, Dunnecarney, who were performing at the opening of the Dunnecarney Trad Fest recently. And I believe that that particular choir is one of only four choirs in Ireland who sing Os Gaeilge. That's what I was told at the opening of the Dunnecarney Trad Fest. And we'll be hearing more from the Trad Fest later in the programme. And I have to say that some of the events they put on were for the whole weekend. That the opening was on the Friday night. They were putting on events right through Saturday and Sunday. And on the Saturday, Friday night, there was a trad session that went on till the wee hours of the morning. And on Saturday, they put on a ceilidh at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and there was also a walk, a historical walk around Dunnecarney, given by Pat Liddy, the well-known historian who does the walking tours of Dublin. And again on Saturday night there was a trad fest that went on way into the late hours. And on Sunday morning they had a special mass in the church in Dunnecarney to commemorate the event, and then they laid on an Irish breakfast for everybody who wished to partake of it. We had to pay, of course, but that happened from early on. I think it was around 10 o'clock in the morning. And then in the afternoon, they laid on, there was a carvery lunch for everybody who wanted to, again, partake of that. And they had the big screens there for the All-Ireland football finals. And they did say, unfortunately, Dublin weren't in them. And everybody would have loved to see the Dubs in the All-Ireland final and to have their lunch in Dunnecarney in St. Kieran's, Craig Kieran's GAA club. And then later that evening, again, there was another trad fest. So it was all happening down there in Dunnecarney that particular weekend. We'll be hearing some more from the Dunnecarney Trad Fest. We will be listening to part of the talk on the history of Dunnecarney and the surrounding areas. And then there will be I did a short interview with one of the organisers, Aidan O'Toole. Now we're going to listen to some of the piece with Dr. Ruth McManus on the history of Dunnecarney. And there's a very brief introduction by one of the organisers of the event, Aidan O'Toole. So let's have a listen to this.
We'll move on to the main event of this evening, which is the talk on Dunnecarney from 1900 to 1950, Market Garden to Market to Market Sub, Market Garden to Market Suburb. So I'd like to call on Dr. Luke McManus.
Okay, Aidan, thank you very much for your intro. Can you all hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. My first confession is, of course, that I'm not from Dunnecarney. So I know that you all know more about this than I do. But I do know a little bit about how Dublin developed over time. And my job is, I work in the geography department in St. Pat's, and my interest is in understanding how landscapes change and evolve. So I'm going to take you on a little journey. We're going to go on a journey back in time to try and figure out what Dunnecarney would have been like. I might even go a little bit further back than 1900, but I'm giving you 1900 as a starting point. And we're going to try and understand really how the place that we know today came into being. And really, it was over about a 25-year period, I suppose, that most of the development in Dunnecarney took place. But let's go right back in time. This is a cheat photograph. It's not Dunnecarney, but it is market gardening in North Dublin, so I think we'll allow it. And if we think back before the development of the housing schemes in Dunnecarney, this was a very rural area. We were well outside the city here in Dunnecarney, and this area was known for market gardening. If you look at back in time at maps, you'll see a lot of fields, you'll see a couple of big houses, you'll see some quarries as well. So if we go back to 1880, see, I'm already cheating, I'm going back, I'm trying to cram in a few more years, and you see the area where we are today is fields. Here you can see Scurlock's Bridge, the cottages here, the alley. And down here we see a number of big houses. So we've got Dunnecarney House, Paramount, Elmount, and they've all got gate lodges. So these are quite big houses. And if you look back at the census, you'll see a lot of servants as well. So these are fairly well-off families living in these big houses. I'll also just draw your attention here to the temple, which is, of course, we're talking about Casino Marino, which we've already mentioned. Okay, and if we go to the newspapers and we see references to Donnycarney from the 1870s, what we find is very much a rural kind of activity going on. So the one on the left here is when Elmount, the house Elmount, was up for sale. And the contents, the furniture and so on, were being auctioned off. And we see down here at the end, the outdoor effects included farm carts, ploughs, hay rakes, corn bins and so on and so forth. All the things that you would need for a country life. Over here on this side, we see in Pearmount, a lovely hunter being sold, that's a horse. And it had been ridden and driven by a lady. So like your modern day cars, obviously, if it's got a careful female owner, it's going to be a much better horse. And down here at the bottom, we have at Donnycarney again, 60 cocks of hay up for auction. So you can see a very much rural lifestyle. And the well-to-do came here in the 1870s. This is the Irish Croquet Championships, which were held, it appears, at least from the image, beside the casino. So these are the well-to-do people who lived and came and visited Donnycarney. Of course, not everybody was like that. There had to be some people to do the work in the fields, in the market gardens. These men are picking vegetables somewhere in Ireland, somewhere between 1890 and 1910. So we'll use them as examples of the kind of people that would have been here at that time. And a picture I took this afternoon, nearly got knocked down by a bus, but managed it anyway, is up the road at the Artain cottages. And these are the kind of labourers' cottages that the workers would have been living in. These are model... If you look at the red brick cottages, the labourers' cottages, across the road, across the Malahide Road, or up the road a bit, or all over North County Dublin, you'll see the same type of cottages, because they were all built to the same sort of plan. There was a huge effort made from the 1880s onwards to improve workers' housing in the countryside in Ireland. And they all use the same basic plans. Little variations here and there, but you'll see the same kind of plan, the same typical house, and you say, oh yeah, I've seen that before. That looks just like the one up the road. And you could be in Donegal or you could be in Kerry. This was part of a huge state effort to improve housing for the labourers, for the rural labourers in Ireland. And that's kind of significant because, as we shall see, in the urban areas, particularly the city of Dublin, the situation was very different. And efforts to improve the housing of the city of Dublin is what gives rise to modern-day Donnycarney. And here's just an effort at what it looked like when it was in a village estate. Okay, if we go to the census from the early part of the 20th century, we get more of a feel of this kind of country type environment. Some of the houses in Donnycarney, and they're listed either under Clontarf West, or some of them are listed as Drumconver Rural, because Donnycarney isn't sort of a separate entity in the census yet. So in 1901, this is a typical family, the Martin family, the father, the head of the household here, Joseph. He's an agricultural labourer. He's married, his wife and his four children living in Donnycarney. An awful lot of the people we have listed aren't specifically listed as being agricultural labourers, but I suspect that they were. And you also find coachmen and people who would have worked in the houses. Big house, we mentioned already. Okay, here's a special one for some members of the audience. And this is what was listed as just being house number 9. It's one of the cottages across the far side of Malahide Road. And here we have Alice Teeling was the head of household. And the rest of the family are the Mahoneys. And there's a big long list of them over here. And lots of kids. But what we learned from the other, if you look at the census, it's absolutely fascinating and you can get totally absorbed in the stories behind the writing. What we have here, when we see Alice Teeling listed in the returns, the house returns, what we see is this is a cottage with three rooms and there are 11 people living in it. So this is pretty cramped conditions. You see others, Christopher Boland as well here is in the same boat. Patrick White, three rooms is seven of them. But you'll also see some of the bigger houses represented. So Thomas Byrne here at the top has 16 rooms for the family. And the family in this case would have included the servants, the live-in servants. Okay, we can come back to the Mahonys in 1911. Just simply to note that they're now described as being Malahide Road West Side, so they don't even have the description of Dunnycarney in the 1911 census. And those that are employed are listed. We have a gardener, a general labourer, and a sand carter. So remember I mentioned the quarrying that was going on in the area. So we're in a rural country sort of an area, well outside the city, and yet we're not entirely immune from what's going on in the wider world. And in 1923, the house Rockfield was actually burnt down as part of a reprisal. It was said by the people who came in, they got petrol from the garage of the house. They spread it all over the furniture and so on. They gave the family time to get out and they burnt the place down. They said it was an reprisal for the shooting of somebody. It was the same night that Moor Hall in County Mayo burnt down. Apparently the house here had quite a lot of important paintings and also works by Pierce and others. Anyway, that's just something, just a tidbit to remind us that we weren't immune from. Even it wasn't just a rural idyll, there was plenty of political stuff going on. Meanwhile, back in the city. Dublin City, not that far away, 2.5-3 miles away maybe, but a very different world, one which was full of overcrowded housing conditions, was experiencing increasing problems with housing into the 20th century. Problems didn't arrive in the 20th century. Right through the 19th century, Dublin was seen as having a lot of housing problems. And if we go back to the 1870s here, we see a lot of discussion about the tenement houses, the problems leading to high death rates. They were so overcrowded, there was so much disease, and that was seen to lead to immorality as well. So there was an argument going on, a need to improve housing conditions. And this was something that raged for a very long time. Now we've seen that from the 1880s, in the countryside, the labourers were getting good housing, well, much better than they had before. But in the city, it was more difficult to make a case. It was more difficult to say that Dublin was different than Liverpool or Manchester or Birmingham. And therefore, the government, which of course was Westminster at this time, wasn't inclined to help Dublin, because if they helped Dublin, they'd have to help all of these other places. So we had a situation that was getting increasingly bad. This picture is only 100 years ago, 1913. And you see the barefoot children, and you see the tumble down. These are actually mews. These are the former stables at the back of the big Georgian houses, and people were living in these. Photographs taken at that time show the interiors of the tenements as well. And they show just how little people had. People were extremely impoverished. This was the only source of heat. It was the only source, or the only place where they could cook the open fire in the single room tenement. And that made it very difficult, as you can imagine, to get decent food and nutrition as well. And Sir Charles Cameron, he was the medical officer of health for the city for many years, and he did it in very, very bad conditions. But he pointed out how people simply didn't know where they were going to get the next meal. They didn't know where they were going to get the money, because a huge proportion of the population, at least a quarter of the population, were unskilled labourers, and they hadn't got a regular or steady income. That made it very difficult to provide housing for them, because how were they going to afford to pay for better quality housing? 1913 was a year when a lot of this came to a head. And you will have If you were around at all last year, you will have heard a lot about the lockout, the centenary of the 1913 lockout. So things came to a head with this major labour dispute. And one of the things that was pointed out, even in the very conservative newspaper, the Irish Times, was that they didn't think the problem of the labour dispute would have come to be so serious if people had had decent housing. So there's this idea that people, because of the terrible conditions in which they lived, became immoral, became bad citizens. And increasingly then there was an argument that if you want to have good citizens, if you want to have a stable society, you should do something about people's housing conditions. This then, of course, coincides rather nicely with the collapse of a tenement, two tenements actually, on Church Street. Now, some of you who are slightly more mature in this room will probably remember a series of collapses in the 1960s, which ultimately led to the development of Ballymun. But 50 years before that, same thing happened. We had this tenement collapse in Church Street. 7 people were killed. One of them was actually Eugene Salmon, who was on, he had been locked out of Jacobs, and he was killed going back in to save a younger sibling. So in the newspaper, side by side, you have the photos of the tenement collapse, this argument, who's responsible, and you have this huge crisis, the city is strike-bound, or lockout-bound, depending on which side you take. So there seems to be a call for something to happen. And what happened was a major inquiry. Happened very quickly, not like today. It didn't take yet 10 years to report either. So within a few months, we had the reports of this inquiry. It looked at the housing that the working classes were living in. 27,000 people were living in what they described as being first-class housing. So it was structurally sound. Didn't mean it was the Ritz, but it was structurally sound. 37,500 were living in houses that were sort of borderline of being unfit for habitation. Because they were falling down, they were so old and decrepit and so on. And then we have more than 22,500 people who are living in houses that aren't just unfit for habitation. They're in such a bad state that there's no way that you can actually improve them. So this is a huge problem.
Yeah, that was Dr. Ruth McManus there talking about the history of Donnycarney at the Donnycarney Tradfest recently